Welcome to episode 458 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. My name is Michael Eriksson, and today I interview Adil Tveiten. Adil probably needs no introduction as this is his fourth appearance on the podcast. I will, of course, link to his previous appearances in the show notes, and they are well worth a listen, so you can go and have a look at them if you're interested. But very briefly, he built up the Norwegian national team in triathlon from scratch and was the head coach of the national team and the sport director of the federation for many, many years, and has overseen countless triathlon successes, with Christian Blumenfeld's Olympic gold in Tokyo 2021 an obvious highlight. But I think the podium sweep in the WTCS race in Bermuda in 2018 is also worth a mention here, because that was a fantastic race and a fantastic event. We have discussed both of those events and much more, including Adil's training methodology in those previous episodes mentioned. But Adil is now the High Performance Director of the Norwegian Swimming Federation, so we will discuss this change from triathlon into swimming. We'll discuss swim training and high performance in swimming, and we will discuss applications and learnings for triathlon, including for age group triathletes. But just before we get into the interview, let's thank our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate products like gels, drink mix, and shoes that are effective, practical, and tasty. And of course, they also make electrolyte products in different strengths, so you can choose one that best matches your sweat sodium concentration. Their products make it easy for you to execute your nutrition and hydration plan in both training and racing, as they are tasty, have practical packaging, and use simple round numbers, so you don't have to do mental math when redlining in a race. They have a free fuel and hydration planner, free consultations with sports scientists, a massive database of case studies, and lots of in-depth and well-researched articles that will give you everything from the basics to the finer nuances of nutrition and hydration. As a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order of 2025 by using the code TTS25 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Adil Tveiten. Welcome back to That Triathlon Show, Adil. How are you doing?
Thank you, Michael. Yes, I'm doing really well, and it's a pleasure to be here again.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for coming back. Yeah, it's been a while. You've changed jobs and changed sports. Maybe we start there. Can you tell us a bit about this transition, professional transition that you've had?
Oh, yes, I can start with that. It's actually a little bit long story, actually. So it actually started back in 2023, where I started a position at the National Olympic Committee as a is a role they call coach, where you then work toward other high-performance environment national teams in Norway, where you're working more with the coaches, the program structure, and also you're the one who is in charge of the funding for them. So I had a kind of have an overall role there, and that was a well-planned that should be a part-time job. And then at the same time, my role in the Norwegian National Triathlon Federation now also was a part-time job, with only focusing on the build-up to the Paris Olympics. And after the Paris Olympics, it's already then planned that I should go in a role in the National Olympic Committee and working for them full-time. But on the way, it's happened that the Norwegian Swimming Federation, they needed the need to restructure the way of organize their high performance sport, and a little bit based on my role in the National Olympic Committee and working really close with all the federation about the same, I was asked if I want to change to swimming as the new high performance director. And as I said, that it was planned that after Olympics, I should be out of triathlon as my main job anyway. And I was really happy to have 1.5 years with the National Olympic Committee, get a little bit more wider perspective of high-performance sport. And then it just suited that it ended up that it was a full-time position as a high-performance director in Norwegian swimming. And yeah, I'm very happy for that. Of course, I still have a real passion for triathlon, and a little bit strange to move, but I will also say that in really high performance environment, it's not healthy for anyone to be in the sport for too long. The national system in Norway, they need a change. They need new faces, new people. So it's kind of healthy both for them and for me. But I want to say that I'm really into triathlon still, and I still do some coaching in triathlon, and I have a really passion for the sport. But then again, when you are changing to different sport, you see that a lot of the same thing. It's all about the high performance. You see young, motivated athletes who put every egg in one basket to try to be the best in the world, and is a lot of similarities of even if it's difference in the way you train and stuff like that. But I just love being in the highest high performance environment that there is. Swimming is really exciting and really complex as a sport. That is, when I got the opportunity, I just needed to say yes.
So when you say that it's not healthy for one person to be too long in one sport in a high-performance environment, is it just because it's so intense all the time? And even though I'm sure your new job is perhaps equally intense, but it's just when you get something new, it's a bit less draining perhaps? It maybe gives you more energy than takes energy? Or how would you describe that, why you say that it's not so healthy to be there for too long in one sport?
Yes, my perspective as a high performance director, is of course very hard to put all the effort into just working for one sport at a time, and you come to a time where you're kind of getting tired. You maybe don't have the same ambitions and motivation as before, even if you are professional and say you have it. Maybe you are getting into one track of how you think you want to develop the sport, which maybe was really good for some years, but maybe as the sports evolve and the athletes are new, it's different coaches that then maybe they need to do things a little bit differently. So I would say that it's very common in Norway when you are employed that you're going from Olympic cycle to the Olympic cycle. And I would say that maybe two Olympic cycles pretty idle. One is too little to do something. In two, you can really do something. When you do three or four, is kind of a bigger chance for a burnout. And also the federation should maybe need to look in someone who can see things from a different perspective. And if I change that to swimming, swimming had the same environment, the same coaches for more than 20 years. And in the retro perspective, you can say that the last 10 years in Norwegian swimming, it was no evolution, no progress, and we were actually going a little bit backward compared to all our competitors. So for sure, they needed a change, and they thought that I was the one who can give that the change. And then I come in, and of course, I've been working with triathlon really intense, but then it's new role, more or less the same role, but I'm not any coach anymore, and it's a little bit different people, different environment, more budget, different setup, and then you start from new again. Then you are like a newborn high performance director starting from zero, and the motivation I have is really, really high because it's some different set. Even if the main thing about the sport, about producing result, is the same, it's still different in the way that give you a lot of motivation and energy boost to continue.
Yeah, makes complete sense. So can you give an overview of what your role and your responsibilities are as a high performance director, and also perhaps how your experience in triathlon and the skills that you have from there, how that helps you in your new role, or how you can use those skills coming from outside of swimming?
Yeah, of course. When I started doing triathlon, my role in triathlon was sport director or high performance director. But at that time, Norwegian triathlon was so underdeveloped and there were no coaches, no structure. So I need to take the coaching role. So as working for triathlon, I would say I was mostly a head coach, and the organizing thing, the overall structure thing, the high performance director kind of work it was doing a little as possible. So when I now start, and when I, one of the things I said when I was going from triathlon to swimming, that when I started with triathlon, we have almost no athletes. We have no club structure. We have no professional coaches and we have no money, but we were still able to produce pretty good result over a 10-year period. When I now go into to swimming, it is a very well-developed system. We have 280 full-time coaches in the swim system in Norway. It's a lot of clubs who have a lot of money, at least compared to triathlon. And the federation also have more money, but we don't have any result. So it's something about the structure that they are maybe too satisfied. It's too many who have this as a safe job to be a coach. You are not challenged too much because it's always a possibility for you to have a job. And some of the structure is about having new members, not about developing the swimmers at the, for a longer period of time. So that is some of the difference. And since the organization is bigger, my organization skills and how I structure the system is much bigger. And also said for fun, when I started doing triathlon, it was very easy to do changes because I only need to agree with myself. So because it was only me, now if, of course I'm a part of a bigger organization and I have almost 10 coaches in all the sports that I'm involved in. And I also in charge of course, the para swimming, but also in charge of, for instance, diving and artistic swimming and water polo. Okay, in Norway, water polo and artistic swimming is not so big, but like in diving, we have 2-3 final candidates for the Olympics in LA. And that is a totally different sport, but they have been very little. They have one national coach who is totally alone. So for him to just to communicate with me, I as a high performance director, used to working in coaching with coaches, I motivate him. I challenge him with some of the way he worked with athletes, how the setup for the national team should be. And then we having a discussion that creates something and you get something out of it. And that is really interesting, even if I don't know that sport in detail, but I know the overall structure. So that is, as I said, it's in the end, it's all about producing the best possibilities for the athletes we have on the national team to reach their potential and to be the best in the world, which is the same in all sport. But as from an organization view, it is much bigger in swimming, and I have more people and coaches that are working under me. So my role is, of course, much more on that level than to be a coach. Of course, I coach the coaches, and I'm in the discussion with the coaches about how we should build up training and stuff like that, but that is not my role. I'm not the coach in the way that you describe the program and what you should do. So that is different. So now that is the big difference compared to what I did before.
I guess the coaches is one of the main, let's say, the main people that you work with, or the main group that you work with would be the coaches, or is it also clubs and or how does that work?
Yeah. Oh, it is both the clubs and the coaches. So In our system, as I said, that is 280 full-time coaches. And you can say that maybe 15, 20 of them is working with athletes at the high level, like on one of our national team, which is, of course, the most important thing to work for that with them. But, of course, they are a part of a club and a club structure. And to have some changes in the way we work on, especially on the long-term development of an athlete, we also need to work closer with the clubs to not, I'm not in the position that I can restructure the club, but I can work with them to change their mind in how they think about long-term development. And if I'm, for instance, one example is one of the challenges we have in Norwegian swimming is that to have the athletes to continue with the sport longer. So when you know the top of the world, in the best in the world are around 25 years of age, you had trouble succeed when almost all swimmers in Norway quitting before they're 20. So to just to make to have a longer career, and that is a little bit how the coach should work to develop an athlete over time, a sustainable developed system. That is one thing, but also how the club organize themselves to support these athletes to continue over time is really, really important. Because as it is now, some clubs see that, okay, if you have an athlete on the national team, it's a big cost for the club. So, but if you're getting new members up who's 9, 10, 11 years old, it's just a big, you're earning a lot of money on them because you can charge the parents a hell of a lot of money to teach the kids to swim. So if you just look at the club structure in Norway or in many other countries from a business perspective, it doesn't make sense to work with high performance athlete if you just look at the money wise. And so it's all about make more clubs to understand that and change the way they think and try to do what they need to do to support their athletes when they really need them. That's maybe from 18 to 25. This is the big black hole in where they have the biggest possibility for develop, but also very hard for athletes if you don't get any support, because it's no money in the swimming unless you are really, really, really good. For most athletes, it's hard sport to be at your best, because it's not like in triathlon. If you are top 10 in Ironman, you make a decent living of it. If you are in a final in the Olympics, you struggle to make the ends meet.
Well, yeah, I don't have that insight in swimming, so that's interesting to hear. And it's a great example with that proposed change of how, yeah, keeping swimmers longer in the sport could make them more competitive, of course. Do you have any other examples of something that you're working with on in terms of the structure or working with how the coaches maybe do things differently to make the swimming more competitive?
Yes, it is a lot of more things. For instance, as I said, if you are a club coach, you have your salary, and the clubs we are very often run by parents who do that voluntarily, and their target is always to try, almost always to try to be the best club in Norway, and the coach in the club is very often then measured on that parameters. So, and then you know from history that between 16 and 18 years of age, most swimmers quit. So you are a coach, you know that is the goal is to have resulted in Norwegian national championship. And you know that likely the athlete is quitting quite early. So then you think, to secure my job for the next year, is better that I push the athletes really hard when they are young, because they will quit anyway when they are 18, and produce good results in national championship, which is for them and their job and for their club likely a good solution, but for a long-term development from a high-performance perspective to produce internationally good results is not good at all. So that is one of the other big thing we're working on. And that was a thing that is very different from when I started working with triathlon. But it was still like one of the similarities that is, okay, in triathlon, you know that you can earn money if you're at a decent level. So when I started working with Christian, Blumfeld, Gustav Eden, I was like, okay, when they are 18, they need to be at a level where they can start earning some money so they feel like it's worth it. But since I was in charge of it, I was very cautious about thinking about the long-term process we need to do, because that was just part of the step in the long-term development you should have. Because I have no one who pushed me, and I was, my role in triathlon was to produce good international result over time. So of course I could very easy have the long-term perspective. But as a club coach in swimming in Norway, is more difficult to have that, and it's very easy to be distracted about the short-term goals that very often comes up. And if you have two national championships a year, and for the youngest junior, you also have the youth championships, you have maybe four championships a year, and you're just working towards them. You have a tapering process, do the race, and that is the only thing you think about. That is a happy when they're 18. And then maybe they win one or two Norwegian gold medal or whatever, but they're still really shitty compared to the best in the world. And they're not going that way. So that is for sure one of the biggest things that I work with, and changing that structure.
Yeah, that's super fascinating. And I'll link in the show notes, there's some interesting articles and research about from football, from Norwegian football, actually. I think there was this research article called As Many as Possible for as Long as Possible, which was about the team of where Erling Haaland played when he was younger, and how they produced a fantastic amount of high-level professional football players for such a small team by focusing on keeping them in the game. And that's an interesting related reading, I think, to this that you mentioned. About on the training side, when you've been working with the coaches, and now maybe we're talking more about the swimming, not the diving or water polo, but swimming itself. Is there something that has come as a surprise to you when you have started to see how the swimmers work or how the coaches work?
Yes, some in good ways or some in bad ways. I must say that I have really respect for all swimmers. It is very different, metabolic profile and how you need to work with a sprinter compared to a long-distance swimmer. But one of the things I was mostly surprised with is how little the top sprinters in Norway spending the time in the water. It was like most of the session was shorter than I as an old age group would do when I go in the swimming pool. And I was like, the first time I thought, why in hell are you even daring to spending 3 hours to go to the pool and do all the preparation, and then you swim for 1500 meters and that is your session. I really, really struggle to understand that. So the amount of time in the water is so much lower than I expected it to be. But of course, then you're getting more insight, and then you are full of respect for all the other workout that do, the gym, the strength. And the best sprinter we had, he's not internationally really, really good, but he was in the Olympics. He was in the gym 6 times a week, from September to December, which I, as a triathlon coach, never did. The Norwegians in triathlon were known to do a lot of good aerobic work with swimming, biking, and running, and the strength thing was a non-factor. We didn't do it. And then we come to swimming, where the sprinter did it almost every day, and the volume that swim was very, very low. So that is for sure the biggest difference. But then if you compare to long distance swimming, then you see a lot of similarities in how we build up the training and the program in triathlon, and that is. It's not exactly the same, but it's very much the same. So of course, it's some surprises and something that is good to see that, how we did with swimming related in triathlon, it is still what the best swimmers do. So it is a mix, yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything that maybe wasn't a surprise to you, but that you think listeners might be surprised to hear about how the swimmers train, whether it be the sprinters or the distance swimmers, other than the low volume of the sprinters?
Yeah, I think that is one of the big thing. The other thing I'm not sure if you are surprised, but even the long distance swimmers, how much they work on the technical part of swimming, how much time we're using on analyzing the swim stroke. We in the Federation, we have one guy working full time just do filming and analysis of every step of the swimming. And it's like when an athlete, if you are a long course athlete swimming 1500 meters, on all races, we split up the race just in each 50 meters. It's not that each 50 meters is the first 15, because then you have the kick and the underwater work, and then you have the swim part, and then last 5 meters it's going to roll and then turns and the kick, and we analyze all these segments in every single 50 meters in a race. So that work is putting so much more effort into it than we do in what I'm used to in triathlon. I think that the detail you're working on the technical bit is very difficult for a triathlete to understand.
Is that mainly from competition footage, or do you, how is that implemented in training? Is it implemented in every training session that video is taken and analyzed, or is it more specific, maybe once a week, or how does it work?
It's a little bit depending on where we are on training camp. Of course, we don't do it every day, but at least once a week, all the athletes is doing some kind of filming and analysis of it. But we sometimes on some important key session, we do it more often. And it's a little bit based on where you are and the coaches who are available. But we have a kind of a system that on analyze expert is actually sitting at home. And if we don't have a national team training camp, the coaches with the athletes on the national team, they're just sending video to him and he gives feedback. He put it into an analyze program and then you see the progress. But you also know that you cannot, okay, when you're working on a technique, it's good to have kind of an instant feedback and do adjustment here and there. So of course, filming in one session and then you analyze it and look at it is important. But for the big improvement, it takes some time. It's not that you change the whole world in one or two sessions, but it's the level you work in is actually really impressive and really interesting. And we see that also compared to the swimming in triathlon, how swimming and the kicking underwater and how much that it changed the sport is so different to what you think about when you do long distance swimming. But when we had the last worlds, now you see everyone on the best in the world in 50 and 100 meters, they are kicking almost 50 meters, which is the maximum length you can kick underwater. And as a triathlete, it's always when you do a turn, it's about getting up as fast as possible to breathe, and then you start swimming. So that is one of the things that is really different, and which we in swimming put much more time to optimize than you would do in triathlon, for sure. Yeah. This is kind of natural.
How else do the swimmers work on technique? Is it do they do a lot of drills, or is can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it is a little bit different from club to club or coach to coach, but I would say in general you do a lot of drill work, technical work, and for instance, when I was working with triathlon, if we had a 2-hour swim session in the pool, okay, the later year we didn't do that too often, but let's say you have 2 hours in the pool, you always will aim for 7,000 to 8,000 meters in the pool. Very effective, do the thing you need to do. But a swimmer who also has spent 2 hours in the pool could maybe swim for 4.5K, and then maybe 30, 40 minutes of that 2-hour session is just technical work, drills, working on the turns, smaller part of it, and or maybe you do some specific sprint work for a really short or a time with long rest. So that is one of the thing that is different. But then again, you don't do that every day, because you have 2 times 2 hours, 10-11 times a week. Most of the session you actually swim as you should do, which is the same as I'm used to in triathlon.
So of the things that that you've seen so far, because you still coach some triathletes, have you changed anything in how you coach the swimming element for the triathletes that you're working with after joining the federation, the swimming federation?
I would say no. Of course, you learn a little bit, and I have get some other idea of perspective on how I build up the swim set, and I maybe with some athletes add a little bit more drill and technical work, but it is mostly that as a coach in triathlon, I am used to do what you need to do. So my swim session is normally like 4 to 5K kind of effective in what you do. So the biggest learning is that by the variation of the main set, and compared to what you want to develop, if you have a threshold set or VO2 max set that you have a wider range of preset that I use in training. But it's not really, really big difference, because when I talk to some of our best long distance swimmers, I said that there's a lot of similarities in how we work with the Norwegian triathlon.
Yeah, makes sense. You mentioned that there were some negative surprises. What were the negative surprises that you've seen?
It was maybe wrong to say negative, but as I mentioned a little bit of it before, that I was surprised at some of the athletes actually were swimming or training quite little. The volume was quite low. One of the things I was most surprised of is like, okay, when I again, I always use terminology from triathlon, because when I started doing triathlon, when we had the goal of being the best in the world, I had a really good understanding that you need to do something better than the rest in the world. And that very often leads that you need to train more. It's not always about training more, but you need to have really good quality in what you do. But very often, it is about training more. In swimming, I was a little bit surprised, especially when Norway, I need to be honest with you, we are pretty shit at swimming where we are now. But still, I've been in the beginning talking to coaches who generally think that their way of coaching the athletes, which is much less volume and totally different than what we really know is best practice in the world, they think that they have a genius approach with much less training than the rest of the world, then they can be the best in the world. And when we are not the best in the world, they don't understand why. And for me, as a high performance coach working with triathlon, that way of thinking is that I just can't believe it. And of course, this is one of the biggest thing I'm working with the club, the coaches we have in the club now. If you want to target to be the best in the world, you need to see what the best do, and you need to practice that and have the best practice. And you actually need to very often do something more, or at least do it better. Don't think there's a shortcut where you can do a little part of what the others in the world do. And that way of thinking is totally unbelievable for me. I can't understand that any professional coach can think like that. But so that is actually one of the biggest negative things. But I must say that things is changing. We are getting a very positive attitude about we're going to do what is needed to do to reach the top level in swimming also in Norway. So, but that was just some of the thoughts things I heard and observed the first months that really surprised me in a negative way. But it's very important for me to say that things is changing, but it will take time before it's perfect.
how much volume do the very top distance swimmers typically do in a normal training week in the world?
Oh, that is okay. I would say that the long distance swimmer, which we have in Norway, is normally will do 11 to 12 session a week, around 2 hours, maybe a little bit fewer, one a little bit longer, which leads to maybe 25 hours in the pool. And then do gym, maybe other aerobic stuff, maybe 3 to 5 hours more. So we, in the overall volume, it's around 30 hours, which is kind of similar to what many in the top level in triathlon do. But I also see a big difference in how you count hours, because when I'm working with triathlon, you are using Training Peaks, and then you actually see in down to the closest minute how many hours you actually train. The swimmers, if they swim 1 hour 40 and the session should be 2 hours, they would say, "Oh, we swim 2 hours." And I would say, "Yeah, we were using 30 minutes before every session to warm up and prepare for the swim set." And then maybe they just do it by 50 minutes, but they're still counting 30 minutes. But when I was working with triathlon, when we did that before the swim set, we counted that as 0 minutes. So the point is, you calculate the hours you train very differently from what I used to. So when the swimmers that I've been training so much, the truth is actually they're training less than they think they do.
Yeah, so in terms of kilometers, can you give an estimate there?
It very often to 70 to 90,000 kilometers per week, for sure. Maybe sometimes up to 100, 110, but that's really, really rare. Yeah. But world-class sprinters, for instance, they are wider range from 20K a week to up to 40K a week. So that is a lot less. And then you have middle distance in maybe like 50 to 60, 70K a week. And then you have the long distance above that again. But that's, of course, a little bit individually. And as a coach in triathlon with the national Norwegian team, they were more or less like 25 to 35K a week. So, of course, it's less volume in the water compared to a swimmer do.
Yeah. Is there anything that you have been able to implement, anything from triathlon that you used to do with the national team that you are implementing or experimenting with the elite swimmers?
Yeah, yes. Some small things, but as I said, I'm not the head coach or in charge, so it's more like how I work with the coaches. And also one of the things that I have been able to implement or talk to them about where we see some changes is, and that is also very typical, maybe Norwegian swimming, but most of the distance you swim is pretty short. So you always have a speed element in your swimming. And most swimmers are sprinters or maybe middle distance swimmers. So it's very common for a swim coach to add some sprint elements in your training, which is nice, which is good. You need to do that. But they very often also are afraid to lose the sprint capacity or the speed. So they must include that even in the easy aerobic session. So that is one of the things I just hate. Of course, we have element of sprint in your training and you have days where you do sprint training, but it's very important when, let's say you have an upper aerobic work, LT1 work, whatever, zone 2, whatever you call it, sometimes you just need to do the work and working for a longer period of time. You don't need to every 800 meter add up 50 or 100 meter with sprints, because then you fuck up the whole metabolic system. And that is one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking to the coach, that if you have 6 other sessions a week when you do sprint elements, you also need the basic aerobic work to build the foundation. Sometimes you just need to do that. You don't need to put in a lot of extra thing on this. But that is a little bit typical swimming. because they are afraid that the athlete think the program is too boring to just do 10, 15 times 400 or whatever you do. So they just need to add something extra. And that is one of the things I've been working really, really hard, that on this session, you do work on what you need to work on, your aerobic capacity, and then you do the other things other days and in other sessions. So that is one of the biggest things I try to change. But of course, then again, some of the coaches who have athletes on the national team have been full-time coach in swimming in the club circuit for 30 to 40 years. So of course, they have a really clear indication of what they think they need to do. So it's not always easy to change things, but I never give up. And we see that is we're doing some changes, yes.
Yeah, no, I think that that is very common, not just in among Norwegian swimming, but everywhere, to make the swimming more fun or entertaining by not having the workouts be seemingly monotonous. So yeah, it's more of a worldwide problem, maybe not at the elite level, but if you look at a master swim program, I think lots of listeners that go to master swim programs will probably recognize what you're saying there.
It's true.
Yeah. Anyway, going back to triathlon a little bit then. So can you tell us a little bit more about, because you are coaching a little bit still on the side, so what is your coaching setup? What does that look like at the moment?
Yeah, so of course, it is what I do outside my swimming job, but I have six athletes now at a different level. Some of them are pro athletes doing Ironman, extreme triathlon, and also have 1-2 short course athletes who try to work on the World Cup, Continental Cup level. So I have a pretty good mix of long distance, short distance, and age groupers. And of course, I don't have many. The one I work with, I want to do as good job as I can. But I do it because I feel like I have a knowledge that I can help athletes to achieve their goals and their dreams. And I really, really love the interaction with the coach-athlete perspective. And even if I now work a lot with other coaches, which I love, it's always the one to be close to athletes, try to understand their mind, how they think, how they work, how to help them to achieve their goals. So my setup is pretty simple. I have a few athletes. Some of them have been working for many years. I don't professional in a really good way that I have a big company doing it, but I do everything myself, very individual program from one-to-one. It very for sure based on the methodology I kind of developed when I was starting working with triathlon, and I of course transformed that into in long distance, short distance, or age group racing. So I'm very into like only one-to-one individualized coaching. So it's not like a mass production of programs or stuff like that.
And do you think that, is it possible that you in the future will ever return to having triathlon as your full-time job, or are you happy with where you are and you'll just see where the future goes?
We should never say never, but I must say that some of the things I just started with, that I don't think anyone should be in a position like this too long. So right now I have a perspective of the Olympics in Brisbane 2032. And I said for fun that when I go into the Brisbane Olympics, I have a one-way ticket because I have a wife from Australia, Brisbane, so I don't need to go back. And that means that I see myself doing swimming for 8 years until that Olympics. I do a little bit coaching on the side for triathlon in these years. And if the setup is right and I still have the motivation and I'm young enough, I will be 62 at that time, I will continue to go back to triathlon coaching. I want to have some years with that. But I still want to learn and develop as a coach too. So for me, it's important to have some athletes now, so I'm still in the game and yeah, so that's without say that this is set in stone, this is what I think right now.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a good plan. And looking back to Paris, so that was, I guess, then the end of your triathlon or, your triathlon stint with Team Norway. Then I know that the games were disappointing probably for you and for the team. You didn't achieve what you hoped for and what you thought that you could do. But can you tell us more about that? And now in hindsight, a bit later on, how do you feel that it went and what could have been done differently perhaps?
Yes, it's a big question. Of course, after Olympics, I felt really, really empty. I felt that it was total disaster. And I was so sorry for the athletes that none of them achieved what I wanted to do. And that is really, really hard for me to absorb. But when you are getting a little bit inside, it's a lot of reason why it happened. The outcome was as it was. But I must say that I was really happy that we qualify a mixed relay team, even if we didn't perform at the level we should at the Olympics. The way the athletes on the team worked toward a qualification with some of the setbacks we have during the qualification period is something I try to remember. I do remember it, and I'm proud of how they worked together as a team. As I said, it was some setback. We have decided during the qualification period that we should go in all in for the latest qualification race, which should be in Abu Dhabi. We were on a safe qualification spot, so we felt that okay, we target that. It fits really well into how we end our altitude training. And on that turn, we also said, okay, we don't go to New Zealand, which was a qualification race to come up really, really late in the qualification period, because that we thought that will destroy our development plans in the training. So we didn't do that. But of course, the team around us for a secure qualification spot there, of course, they booked the first flight to New Zealand and got some really cheap points, which means that we were out of the qualification ranking. So we needed to perform at Abu Dhabi. And then Abu Dhabi just got cancelled because of bad weather that day. So then we were out of the game and we need to perform at the qualification race in Mexico, which they found out was a really good idea to take the weekend after Olympic distance in Yokohama and the weekend before the Olympic distance in Cagliari. A kind of a set up the World Triathlon Center that is very sustainable and environment friendly. Is only the one who worked for World Triathlon who think that. But the athletes took the challenge. They went to Mexico, performed, qualified. And that process, I was really, really proud of. I must say that. And that I try to remember. But then we go into detail to the Olympics. For sure, none of our athletes was at their best. Christian, which were more or less had his own setup and other coach and prepared outside the team at that time. I can say that he has said that in interviews, he said that he felt that he didn't get the running fitness to the level where he needed to be. We saw that in the summer leading up to the games, he was after schedule and he really tried everything he could to get up his level in running, but he wasn't just there. Vetle Thorn, he was kind of, not say he was burnout, but he was not able after the spring season and the training at altitude that summer to get up to the next level. He said he didn't feel really great. He was in good shape, but he was in really great shape. But he also said that when he raced, and Christian had the same approach, that they were in the first group, they were like, okay, we rather go all in to try to get a medal and blow up than not try. So both of them said, if we are paid our card very safely, we could maybe get a top 10 position. But of course, it didn't turn out that well. And but they tried and failed, and they blew up, which I think is fair. But none of them were at the best level. For the women's side, I think that none of them were at the best. It was a combination about nerves, doing some technical mistake at race. So it is difficult to say. I don't want to go into detail with everything, but it was a really hard time for them leading up to the Olympics with the training camp we had in Fongramo and the pre-camp, where more or less they didn't felt that the training didn't go as well as it could be. It's a lot of small margin that maybe some of the training was wrong, maybe the setup wasn't optimal. But of course, everyone worked together as a team and tried to be at their best. But in the end, when you are not mentally 100%, your preparation is not 100%, the chance that you're doing more error in the race situation is bigger. And especially, for instance, the swim in Paris, if you did mistake there, which both the women did, the consequence of that is so much bigger than it could be in other races. So that is more or less destroyed the whole race. And again, it's not an excuse, because everyone who raced in Paris was in exact the same position about it, but it was a lot of delays, the mandatory training on swimming on the course for cancelled because of bad water quality. We need to wake up every day at 4 a.m. to see what kind of message we got from the World Triathlon. There's a lot of small stressful thing. And for instance, and again, it is the same for everyone, but it's like if a day where you were planned to go down to have a swim in the Seine and do the bike familiarization and stuff like that, then you will more or less do all of your training from 6 to 8 in the morning. But then the swim familiarization will cancel, but you still need to go down there and do the bike familiarization. So the time you were away to do the bike familiarization was the same as it was if you do the swim and the bike. But then, of course, you come back to the village and say, oh, I haven't done any training today. So swimming training today, so we need to go to the pool. And then you just block up 4 hours in the afternoon to get a bus, get to the pool where you have the training and do the training and go back. So, of course, a lot of things, small things that were very time-consuming. And I think it's a little bit different how athletes handle that in a good way. And I would say that maybe some of our athletes didn't handle it, that it was a little bit stress for them, and they were not able to deal with that in a really, really good way. And also, in the end, because of all the delays, no one was able to swim in the Seine before the race. The men's race they have a lot of different plans to what it could happen because of bad water quality and whatever. But they suddenly changed the day of racing and the time of racing, which is totally different than was in none of the continental plan. It was totally different. So the men ended up racing after the women at the warmest day in Paris, at the warmest time of the day, which was nothing that, okay, everyone tried to prepare for it, but it was not any information until the day before we knew that going to happen, or maybe 2 days before, I can't remember. But of course, that is just excuse, and the winner for all races in Paris was worth the winners, and it was really good racing, and the best athletes won, and our athletes would never have been on the mix for the podium anyway. So it was for sure something in the training and preparation lead up that wasn't as good as it should be. So that is kind of disappointing.
Do you have any idea of something in the training that could have been done differently to have the athletes in a better position?
Yeah, a little bit. I think it's a lot of small things. of course, I was not a part of Christian's training, so I cannot say what he could have done differently. But I think that they, even if they trained just for Olympic distance the year, the whole year before the Olympic, it was a little bit too much long distance training anyway. And he had also said it that when you with no Ironman training, then you go and race an Ironman 12 days after you do the mixed relay in Paris, and then you won an Ironman, then some of the training you have done leading up to Olympics has not been optimal. But for the athletes that I was involved with, it was a lot of small things. I think maybe the detail planning on all the program and how we executed the workout was not perfect. I would maybe should do some more preparation to prepare for the current we had in the Zealand, which was extremely strong, and we were not, the athletes were not good enough to read the current and understand how we should react to it. So that this could be different. I think some of the swim training we did was not optimal. One of our athletes, female athletes, struggled a lot with the technique and the feeling for the water, and because of that, she lost the self-confidence and she was not able to get that back. And that is something that happened in the springtime. We should be able to change that earlier. So it's a lot of more things. And I must say that the athletes we have, okay, I would say both Christian and Vetle at the best should be in a podium position. But of course, we do see that based on the result they have done the year earlier, it was maybe a little bit too optimistic to think, because they were not good enough compared to what the level to Alex Yee and Hayden Wild, Leo Badger. For the women, they were never good enough to be in a mix for a really, really good individual result. But they were really, really good in the training and preparation at the mixed relay. So we tried to maximize their performance to the mixed relay. Maybe we did something. It was maybe a little bit mix of you need to be ready for the Olympic distance too, and also the mixed relay, that we should maybe be much clearer on, okay, we just go on the mixed relay and try to perform at the best there. Because I think, it's a lot of small things, but in the end, the athletes was not good enough to achieve what we did in Tokyo, no matter what. The base of athletes was not at the same level as we had three-year period in Tokyo.
Yeah, and just a note to the listeners who may not remember, but Vetle Thorn, he was fourth in Cagliari, which was it the end of May?
End of May.
So when you say that he was podium potential, that result really backed it up, that he could have been on his best day, because that was a competitive race. Anyway, let's leave Paris and let's go back to swimming, but now a bit more focused on some practical questions that could benefit the age groupers listening. So we can do these maybe a little bit quickly, but how do you suggest age group triathletes work on their technique?
I would say that the best thing, if you had a possibility, is actually to have a coach who can help you. I would actually say that even if you do your training alone, if you can once a month or whatever pay a coach to give you full attention in 1 hour working on technique, is good. If not, I would look a lot on YouTube, find videos on what you should do, get someone to film you, try to compare what you see on the YouTube, but try to find someone who's have a long distance technique is compared to triathlon, and then you try to take the best out of it. But I think it's very good if you have someone can be on the deck and help you and adjust a little bit, because it's technical thing in swimming is difficult, but it's always good to film so you see what you do, and what they see is very often very different to how they feel it is. So that is the first thing.
Yeah. And how do you think about balancing, how should age groupers think about balancing their low intensity swimming and higher, so let's say above LT1 swimming threshold VO2 max and technique work in the time they have to swim?
I would say that is very individual. If I have an age group athlete, I would always say that you need to have at least one VO2 max, one threshold work, and one LT1 work during 1 week. And I say that if you just have two, you can have two LT2 threshold work and one VO2 max. But in general, I would say three, so you have a little bit of both, of everything. What I think, especially when you're doing LT1 work and also LT2 work, I think that if you struggle with the technique, I think it's very meaningless to do really long continuous swim, because then you are not able to have a good technique. So then it's much better, instead of doing 1,000 meter at the aerobic threshold, LT1 continuously, it's better to do 10 times 100 with kind of a short rest, but so you're able to maintain as good technique as possible. But I think it's age group triathletes very often see what I do in running and cycling and think I need to swim continuously. But if you do it too much with a bad technique, it just gets worse. Try to be rested.
What do you think is, at what point are you fast enough at LT1 to do more of that continuous work? Is it if your LT1 is 120 or 130 or 140?
I think it's a little bit depending on technique, but if you are for sure, if you are well above 2 minutes or let's say 145, 150 per run, so then I think it's better to do shorter work than longer continuous work, because then you maybe need to be above 2 minutes per run. But it's not absolute answer on this. I think it is a balance. And I have some of my athletes for a very long time that just did 100, 200 repeat a lot of time, but now I add it up to 400, sometimes 800. But I always try to have a good variation of it, so you don't do one other thing.
Yeah. And what should age group triathletes do less of in swim training than they tend to do? And what should they do more of?
I that is a little bit what I say. I think really long, slow, continuous swim, you don't need to do so much. So, okay, you do some of the LT1, but it's better to do more of the LT2 work and or even VO2 max work at the higher intensity.
And what kind of testing would you recommend? And let's assume here, no access to lactate or VO2 testing.
I do it very simple. I would say that I just do a simple performance test, like 800 continuously swimming as fast as you can. But of course, the disadvantage with that is it just show you if you're getting better or slower. It doesn't actually don't say so much about what you need to work on to improve your swimming. But that is the easiest thing. I know there are some calculators you can use. You can do, if you do 800 meters max, you can get some calculation of what you swim at 100, 200 different density, but I think it's difficult to get everything. If it was take a short answer on that. Do an 800 performance test, see what you can do, and pace yourself. Take the splits. If you are falling too much apart during the swim, you need to work on your endurance, and that's make it as simple as that.
What about critical speed testing? So doing like 200 and 800 or 200, 400, 800?
Yes, of course. You can do that too. And of course, if you do critical speed tests like 200, 800, you of course we will have a pretty good feeling in what you need to improve. If it is speed who is the limiter or the endurance who are the limiter. But I also feel like if you do 800 meters when you take the splits, I would say that if you are able to pace yourself kind of even, I would say your aerobic capacity is pretty good. If you are not able to do that, you need to work on that. And then you don't have a big limitation with your speed. Yeah. It's like when I jump in the pool now and should do 800 meter max, I assume my first 100 will be 10 seconds faster than the last one. So I don't have any problem with the speed, but I have a big problem with my endurance.
Yeah. So if you do an 800 test, how do you then use these results? And for example, if we talk about your VO2 and threshold and LT1 swim, can you use your, do you recommend, is there a benchmark rule of thumb for how to use the 800 speed to translate into roughly some targets for those different workouts?
I know that there are some calculations you can do, but I don't use that because I think it's so individual. I will not say that you take your average speed of your 800 and divide it into 100 meters, then you could add 2 or 3 seconds and then you get your threshold pace. I think it's so big individual difference that I don't want to go into that path and try to explain, because I think it's too big variation from athlete to athlete.
So when you execute your workouts, you basically would do it based on RPE or?
Yeah. I'll do RPE. And of course, okay, that is a maximal test. But of course, one thing I very often do is also kind of a standard aerobic set. For instance, 6, 5 to 8 times 400 at an even pace, short rest. And then I can see the progression on this kind of set. And then some week later, you can maybe have 15 times 100 best average splits. And there are also kind of tests you can do to have a feeling on what you should work on the next time.
Yeah. Then finally on this topic, if you can give two different main sets, perhaps since you mentioned the threshold and VO2 max, maybe give one of each, one threshold set, one VO2 max set that you think would be a good set for an age group triathlete. And let's here assume 140 per 100 meter as their threshold, because I think that's quite a common level.
Yeah, that's kind of common. Yeah. I would say that for an athlete like that, doing that, I would say that I most of the time make a threshold set around 2,000 to maybe up to 2.5, but let's say 2,000. And then I will have a big variation of mostly I would do 10 times 200. That is, I would say, is a good threshold set. 20 times 100, maybe you can take 2 times 10 with a little bit extra rest after 10. I like a combination of 5 times 200 and then 10 times 100, where you do a little bit longer first. Sometimes that could also be 2 times 400, 12 times 100. So it's a little bit mix of same distance, just continuous swim. Maybe sometimes you have a little bit longer and then a shorter in the end. That is very typical set I will do. So the athletes I coach will, like you say, that 8 out of 10 threshold set will be some of these examples I have now.
And what sort of rest, do you have worked the rest ratio that you work with? Or
yes. So what I try, let's say if you're doing 140 on 100, so I would say that you should go on 155 to 2 minutes, like 15, 20. I would say 100 meters closer to 15 seconds, 200 closer to 20, 400 maybe up to 30 seconds rest. Talking about threshold.
All right.
Yeah.
And the VO2 set?
Yeah, and VO2 set, I mostly do 50s. So I would say that, for instance, I would say 2 times 8 times 50 on 60 on 1 minute. So that is, I assume these athletes that maybe do it on 45 seconds, so then you have 15 seconds rest. And not have a longer rest after 8. I also have some variation, like you maybe do like, it's not pure VO2 max, but if you do like 20 times 50, and then you can have 3 hard, 1 easy, then you can have 2 hard, 2 easy, which just means you should increase your pace. 1 hard, 3 easy, or a little bit different setup, but that's many ways you can do it. Or if you do it that way, it's more like you should go faster and faster because the rest is longer. But we also do the opposite when you should be harder and harder in the end. So that is the latter part, when you doing more and more hard 50s in a row, it will be better for the VO2 max. Sometimes I also do 100s, never more than 6, 2 times 6 times 100. That's kind of on the upper end. Then I would say start on maybe 2 minutes. I sometimes do a mix, 6 times 100, 12 times 50, or 8 times 50. More or less like that. For age group, I would never go longer than 100 meters.
Yeah, all right. And one question, it's not in the notes, sorry, but I just thought of it. How do you view swim toys? Which swim toys do you think it makes sense for age groupers to use, and when do you think it makes sense for them to use it?
I know here all the coaches are very different. I'm the old guy who actually don't like to use so much tools, and if the tools I use is the paddles for strength. But I also know it's a lot of coaches who say that they want their athletes to use pullboard all the time, because when you race, you always race with a wetsuit. I don't totally agree with it, but I don't mind it. But most of the time, I would say the only tool I normally use is paddles for strength work. I also think that just band only is also really, really good for strength work. But that is, if you are ever age group doing 140 per 100, that will be too hard.
Yeah, band and pull boy for that level,
yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah. If you put on a pull boy on that level, that will be better. But I'm kind of a simple guy, so pull boy is not something I recommend doing too much. But I know many coaches are different view on that one.
Yeah. And then just a few reflective questions here to finish off. First of all, what is something that you used to think or believe about training but have changed your mind about?
I think that it's difficult to say. I think I've been more or less thinking about the same thing. But I must say that when I started with the athletes, we hardly never do any VO2 max work. No, I am a strong believer in VO2 max work. Not all the time, and not all the year round, but at different time of the year. And I for sure think we need more intensity on the swim than what I thought 15 years ago. So that is one of the things that changed.
Mm. And how do you learn and improve your craft?
One more time.
How do you learn?
What do you mean by craft?
Well, I guess I mean coaching craft. So maybe this is more related to your triathlon coaching, yeah. Because you're not really coaching in swimming.
Yeah. I would say that I learn every day with discussing training with my athletes. I think that's always important. And I always, I'm where I come from, we are very used to cooperate or in different sports that we are discussing training. So some of the big learning I have over the years is sitting with cross-country skier coaches, rowing coaches, and talk about training, how they do it, how they think, how they implement it. And before I quit the job in triathlon, I spent two whole days talking about altitude training with the Norwegian cross-country skiers national coach. This is really, really big learning to do that. And I'm always eager to learn more. And the discussion is two-part discussion with athletes, learning from how they experience the training, and the discussion with other coaches at the highest level is always something you learn from. And I find a huge inspiration with every coach who's committed to what I do and have. So, that's how I learn.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And is there something that you're trying to learn about at the moment? Some specific topic, or?
It is two things actually. One is related to triathlon, and it's not that I don't know anything about it because we have done it a lot. But I try to dig more into the development of heat training protocol compared to what we did before the Tokyo Games, and how to implement that for age group athletes and also long distance professional athletes. That is, of course, we have done it a lot with the national team in Norway, doing it the last 5 years. But I spent a lot of time to research that and look more into that, to the athletes I coach today. Of course, it's not a new area, but still something that can be done different. I'm doing a lot of research and more and more research and publish articles about it, which is, I found really, really interesting. And the other part is like, when I'm working with swimming, it's like, it's not that I'm more like the physical, logical guy who like the pure training, pure running, cycling, endurance stuff, but the technical aspect and how you work with the skills to develop the technique to be optimized in your training is something I really love discussing with the kind of strength conditional training or trainer we have in our team and other places. I find that really interesting. And some of that is also kind of related to how the diving athletes is working on the special skills, what I need to improve to be able to perform the thing that I do in a dive. I find it so fascinating, and I try to learn just so I can follow a conversation when I talk about the technical aspect of that part, because that is so different to how I used to think before. So that is two aspects, actually.
Yeah, great examples. And what is the best or most influential book that you've read? And it doesn't have to be about training. It can be about anything, but it can be about training, of course.
Oof. This is very out of date kind of answer for me, but the book I read a lot, or I do look at it differently now, I must say that, but when I get into to coaching, the Lore of Running with Tim Noakes was my first book I read from first side to the last page. It's a lot of things that are going on in the world and in development of endurance sports since that time, but that is one of the big key things for me when I read about that and how he looked at thing and all the example he used, that was getting me really eager to go into more of the endurance world. So, but of course, I don't want to use that today as a look at what he wrote at page 284, because it's a lot of things that is not agree on today, but it's at that time, that was the book for me.
Yeah, I mean, still very influential if that was one of the things that really triggered your passion, I guess, for endurance sport. So
Yes, so it's been really important, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much, Arild. That's it for today. Is there anything, any final words or anything that you want to say to the listeners before we wrap up this interview?
No, first I would say thank you for having me, and also you can follow me on Instagram or Facebook. I'm still into triathlon. I'm still very passionate about triathlon, and I will still be at some of the big races this year, at especially the Ironman races. So, I'm looking forward to follow the sport further, and hope to see you around on the races.
Perfect. Yeah, hope to see you there, Arild. Thank you so much for today, and speak to you another time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. And as I mentioned, we will have links to all of Arild's previous appearances on that triathlon show. Also, if you haven't noticed yet, the episode description in your podcast app where you're listening has a slightly new format in 2025 compared to over the last few years. So there's more detail there. A bit more, especially for newer listeners to the podcast, it makes it easier to navigate. And I tend to put recommended episodes that are in some way related to the episode that you're currently listening to as well, even though they are not the same guest. But for example, for this episode, I have plenty of swimming-related episodes as recommended further listening, and also a couple of interviews with Olav Alexander Bu, who was the sports scientist for the Norwegian national team with Arild leading up to Tokyo 2021. And for many years, and has since gone on to coach privately. So there are lots of related episodes in the episode description if you have a look there. Also, again, perhaps to those newer listeners who are not aware, we do have the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, where basically you'll find a blog post or an article that is detailed, goes through all of the important things from the interview in quite a level of detail. Of course, we can't get everything in there, but a decent amount of detail that you can read in about 10 minutes or so, I estimate usually. Might be a bit less, might be a bit more, depending on the length of the episode. But that is a good tool that lots of listeners are finding valuable, for example, to go back to an episode they already listened to and remind themselves of some of the important messages that were discussed. In the next episode, I will interview Matt Silver, who is a physical therapist, and we'll discuss injury prevention, in particular as it pertains to running. So that is a very relevant episode, as statistics have between 50 to 80% of runners get injured in any given year. So might be, yeah, regardless of whether it's 50 or 80, you could call it the majority of people that run, which is unfortunate. But there are definitely things that you can do to at least reduce the risk of getting an injury. And we'll go through a lot of these things in the next episode on the podcast. So stay tuned for that. Subscribe if you haven't already. And a bit of promotion here for what we do at Scientific Triathlon. We're getting close to the start of the 2025 racing season. It might have already started depending on where you are. If you're not quite on track with where you'd want to be and how you'd like to be doing in training, then you might want to consider signing up for coaching with us. And I want to take a different angle here, something that I haven't really talked about before, but lots of people hesitate to sign up for coaching because they tried it before and it didn't work out. And I completely get it, especially if you spent a good amount of money on that. Frankly, there is a lot of coaching out there that isn't very high quality, to put it politely. But that doesn't mean that there isn't also really high quality coaching out there. And I think that if you're looking for coaching, but you're not interested in the poor quality kind of coaching, then consider Scientific Triathlon, because that's exactly what we're trying to do. And the feedback we get from our athletes, the results they're having, and the retention rate that we're having, which is an important marker for the quality of coaching, all points towards our quality being of very high quality. So check out the coaching page on scientifictriathlon.com if you want to learn more. And you can always email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com if you want to discuss in more detail. If coaching is not for you, we also offer customized plans, ready-made training plans, and consultations. So there are different options to suit most people. And that's it. I hope that we can help you towards your goals in 2025 and perhaps beyond. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS25. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.